From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There's news today that two business associates of the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, have been arrested on campaign finance charges. We're going to get to that in a moment as we continue to follow the impeachment inquiry in Washington. Former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, is still scheduled to give a deposition in the inquiry tomorrow. Yovanovitch's testimony would come despite the White House's saying this week that it won't cooperate in the impeachment inquiry. We're joined now by former Georgia Republican Congressman Bob Barr. He was involved in the last impeachment inquiry during the Clinton impeachment, and he is on Skype. Welcome.
Good to be with you all.
Well, and as someone who was pushing for transparency during the Clinton impeachment, do you think that Yovanovitch should be allowed to testify tomorrow?
Well, there's a difference between transparency and following proper procedures. If, in fact, Ms. Yovanovitch is still an employee of the State Department, then she has to follow the protocols of the department. And if that means that the current circumstances under which she has been asked to testify do not comport with the State Department rules and procedures, then it's entirely proper that be worked out before she testifies.
But do you think that it would be right for the State Department or the White House to stop her from testifying?
Sure. I mean, there may be matters that she cannot go into. And the fact of the matter is the rules or the lack of rules under which this whole process is playing itself out is largely a one-way street, as opposed, for example, to the process of the impeachment inquiry and impeachment hearings that we followed back with the Clinton impeachment, in which the minority, that is the Democrats at the time, did have the opportunity to call witnesses and subpoena witnesses. So it was very, very different back then.
But there's nothing written down that says that it has to be done that way.
No, there is no requirement in either the Constitution or the basic rules of the House. But if, in fact, the majority believes that there are legitimate grounds for an impeachment, then it's very important for them to follow precedent, because precedent allows for an open proceeding. And it also places the impeachment where it ought to be placed, and that is in the Judiciary Committee, not as an intelligence matter. This is not an intelligence matter. It is an impeachment matter, a legal matter.
I want to play some sound from early December of 1998, days before President Clinton was impeached. Here you are in the House Judiciary Committee making a statement about the impeachment inquiry.
Sadly, I believe the case we are discussing today is but a small manifestation of President Clinton's utter and complete disregard for the rule of law. Throughout his presidency, his administration has been so successful at thwarting investigations and obstructing the work of Congress and the courts that it may be decades before history reveals the vastness of his abuse of power or the extent of the damage it has wrought.
So you talked about President Clinton thwarting investigations and obstructing. Do you think that the Trump administration is doing the same thing, impeding an investigation into what happened with the call with Ukraine?
No, because during those proceedings from which you just played the soundbite, there was a very different overall process at play, and it was not being conducted in secret, as a lot of what is going on now is being conducted because the leadership of the House has placed this matter before the wrong committee.
So just to be clear, do you think that if the House were to vote, to have an official vote and start a more formal impeachment inquiry, that then the White House should cooperate and allow all witnesses to testify and produce all the documents the Democrats are asking for?
To a certain degree, absolutely. I would certainly expect and would counsel the White House to be far more forthcoming when you have those sets of procedures that allow for due process, even though we're not talking about due process in a strictly legal sense. I think the White House is correct in saying this process needs to be handled with a far higher degree of protection of rights of the minority and of the executive branch than has been forthcoming thus far.
Let me just finally ask you, process aside, are you concerned about the whistleblower complaint and the allegation it makes that says that basically President Trump was asking a foreign power to investigate his political opponent and asking for foreign influence in an election in the United States?
First of all, as a threshold matter, I do not consider, based on everything I've seen so far, that this person is a whistleblower in the sense that we normally and the law considers or contemplates a whistleblower.
But what about the transcript? What about whistleblower aside? There's a transcript that's out there that shows what I was just talking about.
To me, the transcript does not show that. And even if it did show that the president was saying, okay, we have a problem here, and part of that problem goes back to both the 2016 election in the Ukraine and the role of the vice president and his son at the time he was the vice president. And before we move forward with assistance and better relations with Ukraine, you all need to get that matter straightened out and get your own house in order. To me, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that.
That's former Georgia Republican Congressman Bob Barr, who was involved in the Clinton impeachment inquiry back in the 1990s. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's hear more now about the two associates of President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, who were arrested last night on campaign finance charges. Prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan say the men funneled foreign money into Republican campaign committees in order to win influence. Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman are both Soviet-born businessmen who are now American citizens living in Florida. After the charges were announced, House lawmakers subpoenaed both of them as part of their impeachment inquiry. Joining us now is NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
And there are a lot of details to parse out here. What do we know, first of all, about these two men and what they're accused of?
So Lev Parnas is a Ukrainian-born businessman. One of his business partners is Igor Fruman. He is born in Belarus. Both, as you said, are now American citizens. They are based in Florida. They came to the attention of the broader world, I would say, at least the American media, because of their work with the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, to help dig up dirt on former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter, related to Hunter's work for a Ukrainian gas company. Now, Parnas has told NPR that he spent a lot of time working as basically a sort of fixer for Giuliani, setting up meetings with current and former Ukrainian officials, including prosecutors and two prosecutors who have been really at the heart of some of the allegations against Biden.
But as far as you can tell, are these charges related to that work that these men were doing in the Ukraine? Because we're seeing now that the political donations in question were made to benefit foreign interests. We're talking about campaign money?
So here's the it's worth breaking down here. There are four counts in this 21-page indictment. So Parnas and Fruman face two counts of conspiracy, one count of false statements to the Federal Election Commission, and then one count of falsification of records. And as you said, there is a lot in this indictment. There is a Ukrainian link here, other than the fact that both of these men have Eastern European roots. And that link is that essentially the indictment says that they worked to gain access to a then congressman, a sitting congressman who is only referred to as Congressman 1 in the indictment, and tried to get that congressman to push for the then U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, to be removed from her post. And the indictment says that Parnas and Fruman were pushing for this in collaboration with at least one Ukrainian official. Now, that is the Ukrainian tie-in. And of course, we do know that Yovanovitch was removed from her post. She was removed in the spring, and she has been the target of a fair amount of ire from both Rudy Giuliani and, more recently, President Trump himself.
Prosecutors are also alleging that some of this money was intended for a political action committee connected with President Trump or to President Trump.
That's right. There is a $325,000 donation that a company called Global Energy Producers, it was an LLC that Fruman and Parnas set up shortly before making the donation, actually. And what the indictment alleges is that essentially they were straw donors. This was not their own money that they were specifically putting in here, but it was money from someplace else, and they were just kind of a funnel for it. And it was money that was sent to a pro-Trump super PAC. And the problem here is that they were essentially, according to the indictment, working as straw donors. That was the problem with that donation.
Well, here is yet another story about foreign influence in politics surrounding people in President Trump's inner circle. I mean, what do you think? Will this news be something that President Trump's going to have to answer for?
I don't know if he'll have to answer for it. This is something that does tie back into Rudy Giuliani in the sense that he has worked with these two individuals, Parnas and Fruman. I reached out to Giuliani today. He declined to comment. But this does kind of get swept up into the whole broader conversation right now about foreign influence, as you mentioned. And particularly with this Ukrainian link here, I think that this is going to draw greater scrutiny from media as well as Congress. And we have already seen, as you mentioned at the top, that the House committees that are leading this impeachment inquiry into President Trump have subpoenaed today both Parnas and Fruman for documents related to their efforts in Ukraine. And again, the stuff in this indictment does not directly relate to their efforts with Giuliani, yeah. But it's certainly going to draw a lot of scrutiny.
Ryan Lucas, NPR Justice Correspondent. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Maybe you know David Diggs from Hamilton. He was in the original cast. Or from Kimmy Schmidt. Or his movie, Blindspotting. He's also the MC in Clipping, a rap group that's always pushing boundaries.
We are constantly sort of trying a thing out and being like, does this equal a rap song?
That's on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Here's a headline you might have missed this week. The number of cases of sexually transmitted diseases in the U.S. has reached a record high. A new report from the CDC counted 2.4 million cases of gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis in 2018. That's 100,000 more than the year before. There's also been a spike in the rate of newborn deaths due to congenital syphilis. Dr. Elizabeth Taroni is an epidemiologist at the CDC, and she's one of several people who worked on this report. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
And this trend has been going on for some years now, but it looks like through your report that the numbers have reached new highs. How alarmed are you?
The 2018 STD surveillance report documents the fifth consecutive year of increases in rates of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, which are three common sexually transmitted diseases. Combined, more than 2.4 million infections were diagnosed and reported in 2018 alone. This report also provides new data on congenital syphilis, which is one of the most tragic consequences of this growing STD epidemic, and documents that there were 1,306 cases of congenital syphilis reported in 2018, which was a 40% increase in just 1 year.
Well, can we talk about that? Because that sounds serious, congenital syphilis. It looks like a lot of these cases were concentrated mostly in Sunbelt states like Florida, Texas, California, Arizona, and Louisiana. What does it mean? How dangerous is that to an infant?
Congenital syphilis is one of the most tragic consequences of this growing STD epidemic. Of the 1,306 cases, there were 94 congenital syphilis-related deaths. All of these deaths were preventable. We have the tools to prevent congenital syphilis. We just need to make sure that they're being implemented and taking urgent action to break this cycle of increases in STDs in the United States.
Can we take a look at why this is happening? Your report suggests that the use of condoms is falling. Why would that be?
So we have data that suggests that some of the populations most vulnerable to STDs, such as young adults and men who have sex with men, have had decreases in condom use over time. We don't know why there have been those changes in behaviors. What we do know is that there are opportunities to prevent the adverse consequences of STDs. All STDs are treatable, most are curable, and all are preventable. Although most STDs are asymptomatic, which means that most people don't even know they have one of them. And that's why screening is so important to really halt this epidemic.
Another issue is that there have been big cuts to STD programs around the country. The CDC says half of local clinics have seen these cuts. Clinics have closed as a consequence. Less screening, therefore, is happening. What's going on there? Why is the money drying up?
So we know that there's a number of factors that can affect how well programs are funded. What I can say is that the consequences of decreased funding can really affect the most vulnerable communities. For many people who are at risk of STDs, they don't have a medical home or they may not have medical insurance. And those state and local health departments provide a safety net for those persons so that they can get quality STD preventive care. Again, most STDs are asymptomatic. Screening can help identify that. If somebody doesn't have access to that quality care because of reduced clinic hours or shutting down of clinics, that means that they're going to have their infection longer and they're going to inadvertently pass it on to their partners.
Do you think we've somehow gotten to a point in this country now that HIV and AIDS doesn't sound quite as scary as it once did, and I don't mean to take anything away from the seriousness of an infection like that, but that people sort of believe, well, if I get something, I can just go to the doctor. They'll write me a script and everything will clear up. I'll be fine. I mean, is that part of the problem here?
We want people to think of STDs as something that is addressable and preventable. At the same time, we want to make sure people understand that there are really severe consequences to infections. And additionally, don't even recognize that STDs are common in their communities. And a person's chance of contracting an STD is also a matter of how much prevalence of an STD is in their sexual network. So say, for example, a person may only have one sex partner. But if in their sexual network in their community, there's a lot of STDs, even with just one partner, they may be at increased risk. And often it's not about a person's risk behaviors, but it's about their partner's risk behaviors. Hmm.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Taroni. She's an epidemiologist at the CDC who worked on this new report that came out this week showing that a record high number of new STD cases have been reported in the United States. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much.
Little Rock, Arkansas is extending a jobs program that pays people who are homeless to clean up the streets. The program is called Bridge to Work, and in the past 6 months, it's paid a few hundred people $9.25 an hour to pick up trash, and in the process, get access to other important services. Paul Atkins is a pastor with Canvas Community Church, which organizes the program for the city. Paul, welcome.
Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. And Renisha Foxworth, who has experienced homelessness and has gotten work through this program. Renisha, it's good to speak with you. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
And Paul, why don't we start with you? The city apparently thought this jobs program was worth keeping. Tell me how it works.
The basic idea is we pick up eight people, either from our church or from a local day resource center or folks who are actively panhandling, and they go pick up trash around the city, different sites the city has assigned to us, or sites that we just find and decide we need to clean up. We provide lunch. We have a conversation about where they want to go next in life and see if there's a way we can help them get there. A day's work for a day's pay and access to resources that will help them get to the next step to create the life that they want.
Have you been able to help people get a permanent job after this?
Yes. It's kind of a big funnel. You know, well over 400 people have participated in the program. You know, some of them are not looking for anything other than a day's work and a day's pay, which is fine. That's a fair trade. But others, we help them address a legal issue, get back on good terms with their parole officer. We get them some addiction treatment or mental health services. Then we're focused on also the employer part. And we have had some success with some folks getting full-time work, including some that are working with the city now, driving a dump truck.
Wow.
Because he happened to be homeless with a commercial driver's license.
Oh, that's
so
great.
That was an easier one than some of the others. This is a long-term process, which is, I think, one of the reasons the city wanted to keep with us. Our friends' lives didn't become the way they are overnight, and it's going to take a lot of long-term relational love and care and work to address people's needs and get them the life that they want.
Renisha, let's bring you into the conversation because you are the person this program is designed to help, and it sounds like it has helped you already. Tell me about your experience with it.
Well, Pastor Paul helped me with employment services and well, he had let me fill an application for St. James Baptist Church where I could, like, work in a daycare because I love kids. Also, he has given me and my boyfriend, which is Corey Edmondson, like, bus passes to last, like, from the beginning of the month to the end of the month. And I thank God for that because without that, I wouldn't know how to move around.
And it sounds like you can make something you know, not a ton of money, but you can make something like $37
a
day.
Yeah, I can make $37.
Yeah, what's that mean for you?
I use that $37 to, like, give me an idea, stuff like that, stuff that I need, and it helps a lot.
Other than making some money on the days that you worked, what has this program meant to you? I mean, do you think it might lead to something more, something better?
Yeah, it could lead to something better, too, with the money that I made from Bridge to Work program. Like, it helped me grow and be more responsible. I was still looking for a job. I had finally found one, but that didn't work out, so
okay.
I'm still looking. I'm not going to give up. And it's still hard, but it gets better day by day.
Are you feeling more optimistic about the future now?
Yes, I am.
How so?
I see greater things and a lot of doors open, like opening up for me and my boyfriend.
Paul Atkins, can you jump in here and just, you know, what are your thoughts on what Renisha's story tells you about how this program can work?
You know, Renisha doesn't face a lot of the barriers that other people have. But, you know, she's up against homelessness itself because some of the jobs that she's looked at are very difficult to get to on the bus line. So as much as a blessing as the bus fare is, you know, still that makes it difficult to get to work, get to interviews and keep those things going once you do get a job.
Yep.
But part of the thing that I think Renisha illustrates is that, you know, you and I may have grown up with all sorts of people in our corner, teachers, parents, clergy people, neighbors. But, you know, Renisha's got Corey, and now she's got us to try to recreate a little bit of that community of support that kept me going as a young person and hopefully will keep Renisha going so that she doesn't get discouraged and give up.
Well, and now it sounds like the city is pulling for you and Renisha, too, because
certainly
they've extended funding for another year. And look, the city of Hot Springs, Arkansas, not far from you, is looking into starting its own program like this. But how do you take that to another level, from giving people a few bucks for a few hours of work to making a major step towards getting them permanently off the streets?
Right. Well, this has been a big team effort, certainly. We've partnered with our local shelter, Our House, our local day resource center, Jericho Way, the Goodwill Industries, our workforce development office, and all these different agencies working together is beginning to create that network where we know where to help people plug in for whatever kind of work they're looking for.
That's Paul Atkins, a pastor with Canvas Community Church, and Renisha Foxworth, who has participated in and benefited from Little Rock's Bridge to Work program. Thanks to you both, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
American Airlines said this week it is going to keep the Boeing 737 MAX grounded until mid-January. The planes have been grounded for months after two fatal crashes that killed a total of 346 people. And the Federal Aviation Administration still has not signed off on Boeing software updates to fix the 737 MAX. Let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So how realistic is this new revised date of January 16th for getting the planes back up in the air for American Airlines?
Well, American, in their release, said that they, quote, anticipate the resumption of commercial service in January 2020. But, Jeremy, if you just kind of look back over a history of these kinds of releases, not just by American but other airlines, I think the more precise way to look at this is not a prediction that it will be carrying passengers again then, kind of the opposite, just kind of them saying, look, we don't expect it until at least then. And airlines know that they want to make these kinds of adjustments a few months out because it's just less disruptive. If you go into mid-January, you look at flights, not all that many people booked on them. So if you do have to cancel a flight, you can kind of easily move those customers onto other
flights. Well, how much of a headache has the grounding of the 737 MAX been for travelers so far in the airlines? Are they actually canceling flights, or do they just have other planes they can use?
A combination of both. American canceled nearly 10,000 flights in the third quarter of this year. So that's a lot of flights. An airline like United didn't have as many MAXs to begin with and wouldn't have had as many even as it continued taking deliveries. So it was kind of hit in the peak summer when it all hands on deck, you expect every plane to be in the air. But now that you get into this time of year when lower demand, you might sort of be doing some maintenance on your planes anyway, a little less impact. But, no question, fewer flights in the air. And Jeremy, although, moving parts here, hard to quantify exactly the impact of this, but probably somewhat higher airfares than they would otherwise be, because in the end, supply and demand economics, fewer seats means higher airfares, even though fares are rather low in historical terms.
Okay, I want to ask you about a bright spot in the industry, and it's the airline in the U.S. that never had the 737 MAX. That would be Delta. They just posted a very strong third quarter earnings profit. What is driving Delta's growth?
Well, although you want to overstate this, the grounding of the MAX to some degree helps Delta, right? I mean, that demand spills over to some degree to Delta. Now, not in a big way. That's not the main reason Delta's making a lot of money. They're running a really good airline. They're more reliable than their competitors in terms of on-time performance, losing fewer bags, fewer customer complaints. And Jeremy, just demand is really good. I mean, they named a couple of places. Asia, for example, not great. A place like Detroit, with all of the automobile traffic subject to trade tensions. Delta has a hub there. That's soft. People buying tickets in Europe, but not people buying tickets to Europe from the U.S. Easier to look at the rest of the picture. They kind of had to stretch to say, what are the places that aren't doing well? Generally, a very good story for Delta, and no signs of it ending soon.
And in fact, they just took a 20% stake in the Latin American airline holding company, LATAM.
Yeah, the former partner of American Airlines. So here you have the strong getting stronger. American losing a key partner there. Delta gaining a key partner in what had been a strength for American. American's the strongest U.S. airline in Latin America.
Seth Kaplan, here and now, transportation analyst. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And let's hear more now about the history of the Kurds and their often troubled alliances in the region. Michael Gunter is a political science professor at Tennessee Tech University. He's written several books on the issue. We've reached him via Skype. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And there are about 30 million Kurds living in the Middle East. It's the largest ethnic group in the world without a country. Tell me more. Who are the Kurds?
Kurds are a separate ethnic group in Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and for our purposes today, Syria. Now, what distinguishes the Kurds is that they do not speak Turkish and they do not speak Arabic. Kurdish is a Indo-European language, more related to English and European languages than it is to Arabic or Turkish. Kurdish is an Iranian language. They have been semi-autonomous for hundreds of years until late in the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire began to centralize, and that actually led to some beginning awareness of Kurdish nationalism. The trouble with Kurdish nationalism, however, has been its divisions. The Kurds looked at themselves primarily as Muslims rather than to their ethnic group until recently.
The Kurdish fighters in Syria seem like an interesting group. Women are fighting on the front lines. We read that they were inspired by a Bronx-born socialist. Tell me more about who they are and how in their philosophies.
The Syrian Kurds are the smallest group of Kurds in these four states, maybe 2 million Syrian Kurds. And until the Syrian civil war that began in March 2011, we heard almost nothing about the Syrian Kurds. But when the opportunity came because of the civil war, the strongest party very quickly that emerged is an affiliated party with the PKK, which is a Marxist party in Turkey that has become more moderate in recent years. So the party that runs the Kurds in Syria is a socialist party. Yes, I would say that.
Hmm. Take us back a century at the end of World War I, when it looked as though the Kurds might actually get their own autonomous state. What happened?
Well, it might have looked like that, but the Kurds were not ready to even have a Kurdish nationalism, alone their own state. So when the negotiations occurred after World War I, the Kurds were not organized enough. They were tribally divided. So at the end of World War I, the attempt to have a Kurdish state fizzled very quickly.
And what role did the United States have in abandoning what seemed like a promise at the time to many Kurds, I'm sure?
Well, it's true that President Woodrow Wilson promised self-determination as a way to break up the Ottoman Empire. But unfortunately, President Wilson had no idea, really, the enormous amount of different ethnic groups there were in Europe or the Middle East. So the United States really walked away from any of this after World War I.
What happened with the Kurds after World War I in the time leading up to more modern history in the Persian Gulf War?
The Kurds, after World War I, were put into four different states, as we said, and the Kurds, as a reaction to the attempt to assimilate them, began to form their own Kurdish nationalism.
And is that why today the Turks consider the Kurds to be terrorists, because of that growing nationalist sentiment?
And because that sentiment has been expressed violently.
Explain.
Well, the Kurds began in 1978, the rebellion under the PKK and Abdullah Öcalan, their leader. And it was a reaction to Turkish attempts to assimilate the Kurds and deny any rights to the Kurds as a people, the Kurds.
How did the Kurds become such valuable allies in the war against ISIS?
The United States tried practically everything else, and the other ethnic minority groups in Syria turned to be duds, and Turkey was more interested in fighting against a possible Kurdish problem than ISIS. So almost by default, the United States hit upon supporting the Syrian Kurds against ISIS, and it worked. The Syrian Kurds were fighters, and they also were fighting for their life against ISIS.
Well, Henri Barki wrote in Foreign Affairs recently that as recently as 2017, the Kurds were enjoying something of a renaissance because of this, because they had gained territory and pushed back the Islamic State. But today, they're under attack again. The Turkish forces have crossed the border into Syria. What do you think? Will the Kurds ever see their own homeland established?
Yes, but we cannot predict when that will be. But you ask me, starting in World War I, you can see since World War I, the Kurds have become more and more ethnically, nationally conscious. Already in Iraqi Kurdistan, you have a de facto state. And in Syria, Rojava is a de facto Kurdish state, which is what is exercising Turkey so much right now.
That's Michael Gunter. He's a professor at Tennessee Tech University and an expert on the Kurds. Professor, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And now that it is fall, everybody wants to go apple picking. So let's talk apples, which make, of course, great tarts, cobblers, and pies, with Kathy Gunst, who has brought us three delicious-looking savory apple dishes. Kathy is our resident chef at Here and Now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Hi.
And so, do you pick your own apples, by the way?
Sure, when I can. I actually have a few friends that have beautiful trees. I mean, think about it. There's nothing fresher than taking fruit off of a tree. There's no transportation. It doesn't travel anywhere except into your mouth, in your kitchen, and hopefully to try one of these three savory dishes. Yeah, everybody thinks, oh, apple pie, apple crisp, apple cakes. It gets all the attention. But I have been experimenting and found that the earthy, sweet, juicy flavor of apple lends itself to salads, stews, sauces, condiments, really a lot.
Okay, well, you've tempted us. Can we dig into some of the apple dishes that you brought us?
Absolutely. Let's
do this salad. It has roasted apples in it? You were roasting apples?
Yeah, I roasted apples, and it's also got a variety of mushrooms. Mm. And I say, if you could gather all the earthy, sweet flavors of autumn and put them on a plate, it would look and taste like this salad, right? It's almost tastes like the woods or the forest on one of these cool fall days. So I took a variety of apples that hold their shape well when they're roasted, and then I took shiitake mushrooms, oyster mushrooms, roasted them with just olive oil, salt, and pepper, and served it over a bed of peppery arugula.
Which apples hold their shape well when they're roasted?
Well, I'm so glad you asked me that, because there are certain apples that are way better for eating, like a Macintosh, but surprisingly, a Granny Smith, which is just so overlooked, is a great baked apple because it holds its shape. An apple called a Mutsu, which I absolutely love, they're less tart, they hold their shape really well. Braeburn, Winesap, Pink Ladies, Jonagold, these are some of the varieties that are delicious to eat raw, but also work very well cooked.
Can you talk about roasting an apple? Because these seem lightly roasted.
They are.
How do you do it?
So I peeled them, I cored them, and I cut them into thick 1-inch slices. They're big. And I toss them with a little olive oil. The thing people don't realize about apples is that they're quite delicate and they can be fragile. So you want to do it with a delicate hand. Salt, pepper, olive oil, 400 degrees, 15 minutes max, and the mushrooms roast alongside, and suddenly your kitchen smells like that hike in the woods you're wanting to take.
I might start saying these two things go together like apples and mushrooms, because it works perfectly.
Isn't it lovely? Right. They're both of the same season.
Kathy, let's get to this pork dish. Now, pork and apples do go together.
They do indeed, and this is I took a boneless pork chop. You could use a roast, a whole, you know, roast pork as well, and I browned it, and then I again peeled the apples, a few different varieties. This is something else. Like good wine, like good sauces, you balance the flavors. This has got sweet apples, somewhat tart apples. The more the merrier. Yeah. I took leeks out of my garden. You could use onions or shallots. A lot of fresh sage. Sage and apples have a lovely affinity. And then I threw some apple cider over it, put it into a hot oven, and it's an instant cider sauce.
Nice and tart, actually, and actually a little spicy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So a few of the apples do have a spiciness to them, but the pork is hopefully super tender, and with that cidery sauce and the leeks and apples, great, great dinner
Delicious.
For this time of year.
You've also got a chutney here.
I do.
Apple chutney.
And if you are thinking what most people think when I say I make my own chutneys, they're like, yeah, well, that's what you do for a living, but I don't have time to make chutney. This is simple. It's apples and golden raisins and turmeric and chilies and a lot of fresh
ginger.
That's
what was spicy. I think I got it mixed in with the other one.
Yeah, because the pork's not spicy. I added fresh chilies to the chutney, and I just served them to you with some little naan, Indian bread, that I just heated up with some butter and cilantro. But this apple chutney with pork, the apple chutney on a cheddar cheese sandwich, wow. And it will keep in your refrigerator for 3 weeks.
Let's talk about that. Tips, Kathy, for buying and storing apples.
Well, it's really interesting because a lot of people recommend that you refrigerate apples, but I don't. And I like to keep them in a cool, dark spot. You don't want them on a windowsill exposed to sunlight. But I find that when they're in the refrigerator, they develop brown spots much quickly.
Really?
I mean, many people will argue with me and go at it. Shopping for them, it's pretty basic. No bruises, no bad spots. Firm. You don't want to feel saggy skin. That's kind of gross, isn't it?
No,
but anyway, you know, like you want a firm. And also the color should be vibrant, whether it's a green or a bright red or maroon or pink. But the color should be what the color is supposed to be. And also people overlook this when you're shopping. Smell the apple. When you go apple picking, one of the first thing people say is, it smells so good out here.
What are you smelling for?
You're smelling for flavor, actually. You're smelling for like cinnamon and spice and cidery smells and apple odor. Hmm. Apples actually have a scent, and that's what's so delicious about them in these savory dishes, the way they lend their perfume to anything from pork to an Indian-style chutney to a beautiful fall salad.
You're smelling for cinnamon, spice, and all that's nice, Peter. That's
beautiful.
Okay, we've got all these recipes at hereandnow.org. Kathy Guntz, Here and Now resident chef, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.